Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Kadampa Center. This is the Discovering Buddhism class, and we are very lucky to have Venerable Robina come in and substitute for me. My name is Stephanie Smith. My nickname is Steep, which a lot of you will hear me being called, which is totally fine. And we would love for you all to come back next Monday if you would like to continue taking Discovering Buddhism. This module is on how to develop bodhicitta, which fits very well for this little pre-Venerable Robina announcement that Susan Potter and myself are going to make. So Susan Potter is one of the board members on the Kadampa Center, and a lot of people have never met any of the board members, and so we'd like to be able to introduce them so that you can feel free to ask them any questions you have about how the center is run and all of those kinds of things. And for those of you who have been coming to Monday nights, you know that I always give a little pitch on generosity at the end, and now we decided to do that at the beginning. And first we want to start off by thanking all of you for the donations that you've made and continue to make to the center. It's huge. It allows us to keep the lights on. And if you look at the internet, you'll see many classes like this are offered, but for quite a significant chunk of change. And what we do instead is we just trust that we're going to get the money of through donations so that we can make it available to everybody and offer it for free. And because of you all, we're able to do that. You know, when I first discovered Buddhism, it was before there was a Discovering Buddhism class, and I remember I felt so lucky, and I felt lucky, and I also felt nervous. I felt lucky because I finally found these teachings, but I also felt nervous that I would never find them again in another lifetime. And I remember asking Geshe-la about that, and he just kind of laughed, like, well, you really don't understand karma then. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you'll create the causes to meet it in another lifetime. And one of the ways you create the causes to meet it in another lifetime is to protect it in this lifetime. I remember there was a translator of some Tibetan texts, Jeffrey Hopkins, and he said, if he wants to be able to read Dharma in his next lifetime, he has to create it. So he translates texts, and he helps pay for the publishing of these books, and he feels like that is his guarantee that he's going to be able to read Dharma texts in his next lifetime. So similarly, all of us are contributing to the preservation. So the FPMT, which is under the umbrella under which we operate, is the foundation for the preservation of the Mahayana tradition. Because it's not a guarantee that it would be preserved. Look what happened to Tibet. So to be able to keep all of that alive for ourselves and for everyone else, there's a lot of different things we can do. And there's volunteer things that people do at the center, and there's also contributions. And you'll see all kinds of boxes outside here waiting for contributions. So we encourage you to contribute. And if you put Discovering Buddhism at the bottom of your check or on the envelope, then I might win a trip to Hawaii. So go for it.
You are such a good teacher, Steve. But we were on the board together, but I'm not on the board right now. I'm on the Financial Development Committee, so just it's a little small difference, but thank you. But I enjoyed being on the board with you when we were there together. And so I will talk about the mundane part of this, which is the mechanics, which is just how to actually make a contribution, since Steve put it so eloquently. There are envelopes, for one, that you can use to insert a check or actual cash. There's a place on this envelope for a credit card that you can write in. Or out in the bookstore, you can just ring your card through the MasterCard or the Visa machine, I'm not sure which it is, and you can make a donation that way. You can go online. There are still sponsorships available for Venerable Robina, so you could go online and sponsor that way. You can go online and make a donation. We are trying to make it as easy as possible, so because the donations really are what make this center possible. Yes, ma'am. You in the front row.
So if I want to make a donation in honor of somebody's birthday or wedding or something, can I do that?
Yes, especially you can. Thank you so much for that question. Yes, we do have a little pamphlet out in the literature rack for honorariums and memorials. And, in fact, somebody asked right before Christmas if it was possible to do that because they wanted to honor somebody at Christmas time who already had, you know, it was one of those situations, somebody who has everything. And so I think that person is in this very room tonight. I don't see him or her, but I saw that person come into the lobby. So yes, that's very appropriate to do. And we have a card that we send to the person on your behalf saying, oh, a contribution was made in your honor, clearly not in your memory, but if it was in somebody's memory, it would be sent to the family of that person. So thanking and acknowledging that. Other questions? Well, this was clearly unrehearsed, but thank you so much for all of your support. And it is true that I feel like the problems in the world seem overwhelming sometimes, maybe just to me. And I feel like my coming to the Kadampa Center and contributing here is sort of the thing that I feel like I can do to help. So thank you very much.
So we have I'm not sure exactly what time Venerable was going to arrive, but somebody out there. Jill, are you going to alert us when she gets? Okay. Do you have any idea if she's on the way? So are there any questions about discovering Buddhism or about this module, developing bodhicitta? Yes. Uh-huh. Craft. Well, we do need to eat, you know, and there's nothing wrong with pleasure in chocolate cake. There's nothing wrong with it. I mean, I love this definition I learned of renunciation really helped me a lot, which is that renunciation doesn't mean going away from the world. It means knowing that the world goes away. So therefore, you hold things loosely. You don't hold them so tight. You still enjoy the chocolate cake, but you understand that the pleasure isn't all 100% coming from that cake. And so you enjoy it differently. You know, but there's still, especially when you have renunciation, you're more generous. You offer things more freely. You would be building humongous chocolate cakes and giving them to people. You'd just be so generous, we couldn't even describe it. So I think maybe, in one of the books, I think that's offered for free out there, Lama Zopa Rinpoche's book, I can't remember the name of it now, but he talks a lot about do whatever you do, whatever craft you do, whatever you're good at, do that with bodhicitta. So if you're a hairdresser, you know, be an incredible hairdresser, and as you're doing whatever people want to their hair, you can do that with bodhicitta. It just like amps that right up. So whatever craft you have and skill you have, you combine that. It's not that you should stay away from those things. It's, you know, does that help? Okay. Yes. Gosh, it's like a pop quiz.
Uh-huh. I wonder which one of those are there, because I don't know how
okay.
to follow it.
Okay. Who's here last week? Okay. Saved by the Bell. Right. Okay, so...
So I want to read this little Lamrim prayer as our motivation tonight. It's one that Lama Zopa Rinpoche has translated. And it's a very short Lamrim prayer. I mean, it has all the aspects of the path in it, and so it's auspicious. It's a quick way to put all the points of the path in your mind. So I'll just read it. You think about the meaning. Make it our motivation. Okay. The essence encompassing all the Buddhas, originator of all the holy dharmas of scriptures and realizations, principle of all those Aryas intending virtue, to the glorified holy Guru, I go for refuge. Please, Guru, bless my mind to go in Dharma, Dharma to go in the path and to not have obstacles to the path. Please bless me until enlightenment is achieved, like the youthful Norsang and the Bodhisattva always crying one. He's this famous guy who, as soon as he heard about sentient beings, he'd burst into tears. Think about a sentient being, he'd burst into tears. See one, he'd burst into tears. Always crying one. To devote to the virtuous friend with pure thought and action, whatever is done, see it as pure, and to be able to accomplish whatever is said and advised. Because basically by seeing this body of freedom and richness, which has great meaning, is difficult to find again and is easy to perish. An action and result so profound, so difficult to bear the suffering of the evil migrators. To sincerely from the heart go for refuge to the three rare sublime ones, abandon negative karma, and accomplish the practice of virtue according to the Dharma. This is the graduated path of the lower capable being. And I like to call it junior school. By depending on that, even though one has achieved the mere higher rebirth of a deva or human, because of being under the control of not having abandoned the disturbing thought obscurations, the delusions, one needs to experience suffering endlessly in this samsara. Please bless me by thinking well about the way of cycling in samsara to be able to follow day and night continuously the principal method liberating from that, the three precious paths of training. This is the graduated path of the middle capable being. But depending on that, even though I achieve the mere liberation, because there's no sentient being of the six types who has not been my father and mother, please bless me to fulfill their purpose. Please bless me, my thinking like this, to change the mind from the lower happiness of nirvana and generate the precious thought of enlightenment, bodhicitta, through equalizing and exchanging myself and others, to be able to follow the conduct of the victorious sons, the bodhisattvas, the six perfections, and so forth. This is the graduated path of the great capable being. By having trained in the mind, by having trained the mind in the common path like this, I have no upsetness in experiencing the sufferings of samsara for a long time. By seeing as unbearable, especially with compassion towards the sentient beings, entering the quick path, the teachings of the Vajrayana, and protecting my samaya, my commitments, and vows more than this life. Please bless me to be able to accomplish quickly the unified Vajradhara state in one brief lifetime only of this degenerate time. This is the graduated path of the secret mantra, Vajrayana, vehicle of the greatest capable being. So I forget completely what we talked about last week. I know it was bodhicitta. That's about the best I can remember. But I really forget if we... I forget. I'm sorry.
Three of the seven.
Oh, did we? Thank you very much. Oh, dear. Three of the seven.
Right.
Starting with equanimity.
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay, that's right. Thank you for reminding me. That's brilliant. Okay. I think I probably repeated what Stephanie already did. Where is she? She's here tonight, isn't she? Deep, where are you? I thought she's here. Oh, okay. So, okay, well, anyway. Okay. Yeah, so the basis, equanimity, this heartfelt recognition that the sentient, that all sentient, that enemies, friends, and strangers, and that's all there are. There's no fourth category of sentient beings. They all fall into one of those. They're equal from the point of view of wanting to be happy. And the thing is, this is a very, like I'm saying, a very precise thought to have, a clear recognition, and it's the basis, the foundation of building love, compassion, bodhicitta, to grow stably, because it's all sentient beings. We're trying to have love and compassion for all sentient beings, based upon the logic that they want to be happy and they don't want to suffer, as opposed to the logic of samsara, which is I only want those to be happy who make me happy. That's about it, you know. So the second one, as we said, all sentient beings have been my mother. The third one is the mother's kind, and that's like 3A and then 3B. We did that, didn't we? That all sentient beings are kind. Then it moves into, and then therefore the next one, number four, is the conclusion. I must repay their kindness. That's the conclusion. I must repay their kindness. On based upon that thinking, you know. Then the next three, seem to be fairly kind of almost simple points, but they're just using, all they are, keep remembering, and this is always surprising to us, it's using logic to argue with ego's very entrenched views. This is how you remove them at a deep level. Just having sort of superficial sentimental feelings just isn't enough. We've got to use logic to slowly unpack and change fundamentally the primordial misconceptions of ego that see things in the exact opposite way. And these things seem off simple, but they're really quite shockingly unusual to us. I mean, who would ever think, you know, that all sentient beings have been kind? It's absolutely easily provable, but we never think it. We don't think it. It's not complicated. It's quite surprising. So this next one, repaying their kindness, that's the conclusion. Now we go into the ones of the other model, which comes into this, the other methods, the more radical methods of exchanging self for others, of the Lojong method of achieving bodhicitta. According to all the Tibetans, all the lamas, and all the traditions, this is the more radical, the more marvelous, the more amazing way to really rip out self-cherishing. So the next one, it's to recognize, to think about the logic of the fact that all sentient beings are the same as me, which is the same as the enemy, friend, stranger. But the difference here is, as opposed to being same as each other, we're now using us as one group and everybody else as the other. That everybody else is the same as me. So each of you in this room right now, isn't it? Each of us is in the center of the room. And that we're surrounded by others. That's naturally, isn't it? I'm not called other, I'm called me. And so are you. And everybody else is other. So this point, like all these points, seem awfully simple. But to actually get them in our heart is kind of insane, you know? So this one is so simple. And this is how they talk about learning to exchange, you know, equalize and then exchange oneself with others. Equalize and then exchange. We've got to equalize first. First get to see this outrageous idea that, hey, guess what? You're all the same as me. You all want to be happy. You all don't want to suffer. I mean, it's like, duh, you know. But when we, intellectually, again, it's not like emptiness. It's not easy. It's easy to see the logic. Quite quickly, we can prove it. But therefore, we think it's easier. Love and compassion are easier than emptiness. Well, like I was saying last week, you know, this stuff scares the life out of me. This is much more outrageous than emptiness. Much more outrageous, much harder to accomplish actual love and compassion, actual bodhicitta. Insane. I mean, the very fact, the way they talk about it in the teachings, that the Hinayana Arhant can achieve this quite emptiness quite quickly, but it takes countless lives to get bodhicitta. So obviously it's more difficult, obviously. But it sounds, we always think love and compassion sound cute and nice. You get my point. And love and compassion for our beloveds is cute and nice, and it's dead easy. There's no effort in loving and compassion for your beloveds. But here we're talking about love and compassion for the ugly ex-husband and the torturer and the rapist of your child. I always like to use extreme examples just to remind us. This is where it seems completely demented. Or love and compassion for that person who just butted in the cinema line. Hey! Or in security at the airport, where, you know, it's my experience, I live on airports, just, you jump in a long line, there's going to be a war. You probably have to get a vote of confidence of everybody in the line before someone dares to say, you can step in front of me. Everybody behind you has to agree. Everybody behind you, the 47 others, they've all got to agree. Then you can put somebody in front of you. It's not up to you, you know. It's like outrage. So forget about terrorists and pedophiles, excuse me. You understand? So I really love and compassion. It even sounds so nice. I'm just too scared to say the words. Okay, I'll try and calm down and talk about them. Okay, so exchange, equalize yourself with others. Oh my God, you know. At least this one. Already insane. At least this one. See that everybody is the same as you in wishing to be happy and not wishing to suffer. Absolutely mind-boggling, you know. So, of course, the conclusion from this is already outrageous, if you're all the same as me. And then you use all these funny-looking, seemingly ridiculous arguments to use the logic, well, you know, there's many, even if there's two of you and one of me, two's more than one, therefore you're more important. Excuse me. Ego doesn't want to know that. So we can see this is where it's so surprising, because these words are quite easy to understand, but to get inside and genuinely exchange yourself with, you know, equalize yourself with others. At least see others as equal. And then the next two points, and this one seems quite simple, then the next two seem even simpler. It says, well, then think about the... Hang on, just a minute, I forget something. Look up my list, I'm sorry. Where is it? Yeah, that's what I thought it was, isn't it? There's nothing missing there, that's the one. Okay, that's good enough. So the next one is the disadvantages of cherishing yourself. We don't see any normally. Okay. You know, First of all, don't remember this word cherishing is the one they use in Tibetan. It's self-cherishing. It sounds nice. Like I said last week, a friend of mine heard it. She didn't know about Buddhism, and she heard about a course at Milarepa Center about self-cherishing. She said, oh, what a lovely course. I must go to that. I want to learn to cherish myself, she said. She got a big surprise when she heard she wasn't supposed to. But if you called it a course on selfishness, we'd understand. So don't think self-cherishing is some special fancy Tibetan thing. It's another word for selfishness. And that word for us, we guess, that kind of feels like a dagger when someone says you're so selfish. That's what it means. Very simple. And it means putting self first. And remember, like I said, you know, if you look into the earlier stages of practice, the main obstacle is said to be attachment. But there's another way of putting it here. It's the main obstacle said to be selfishness. And for me, it's just another. It's like saying it's another slant on attachment, putting yourself first. And the whole reference point here is to learn to exchange self for others and put others first. From the first moment of which is what bodhicitta is, you know. So this next one is think about the disadvantages to you of being selfish. Now this sounds peculiar to us too, because we seem to think we shouldn't be thinking of the disadvantages to us, you know. But as His Holiness said, I remember when I first heard about this bodhicitta stuff, I thought, like I told you, I thought these people were mad. How can they say this stuff with such a straight face? This incredible level that they're talking about, as if it was something natural. It's sort of like it's like the accomplishments of a saint, and we don't tend to think we can be saints. You know, it's only special people who are saints. But all these practices are exactly that. The techniques that have been passed down in an unbroken lineage, right back through the Tibet to Shantideva, the unique practices from Shantideva, and then right back through the great Mahayana tradition. You know. Unbroken oral lineage of these practices, which is what gives them so much power. So then I heard His Holiness say, you want to benefit others? Practice compassion. You want to benefit yourself? Practice compassion. Then I thought, now I understand. Because it is too high to think of going to that level of compassion. But this idea of seeing the advantages to oneself, which is using it to help us at the level we are at, is so sensible. And once we see this, it's a no-brainer, you know. Then it can go to the level where it really is beyond self. You can't get beyond self before you're ready. So see the advantages of practicing goodness, you know. This is very powerful. And this is even right from the beginning. The very logic, same logic, in the very beginning stages of practice, the reason not to kill is for your sake. So the reason to be compassionate is for your sake. When we get that, then we really know, then we can really internalize it. Because we know right now we are completely clinging to the sense of self, and we know we want to be happy. Well, this is so powerful. See the disadvantages to you of being selfish. So maybe it's hard to see this because we don't like the term being selfish. We kind of crack jokes about being attached. But being selfish sounds really hurtful if someone says you're so selfish. So, I mean, it's easy to think of other people who are selfish. Without being mean, just observe. That's okay. And look, you can see their lives are miserable. It's obvious. Obvious. If a person is mean, self-centered, talking about themselves, always moaning, always complaining, therefore always fighting with people, upset, criticizing. It's another way of putting being attached and angry. It's a different slant on it. You can see, they're horrible to be around. Nobody likes them. They don't get what they want. Nothing works. People don't want to help them. They drive people away. Then, you know, just look into ourselves. But this is, it's feelings, I mean, to say you're attached, for me it seems like, yeah, we're all attached, it's okay, you know, that's attachment, ha ha ha, crack jokes, oh, I'm so attached to chocolate cakes, blah blah blah. Oh yeah, I'm so attached, I'm so needy, want people to love me. It sort of feels sort of something, but there's something about being selfish. That's, you know, I don't like that. I don't like to think about that one, being, you're so selfish. Putting yourself first, it's very close to the bone, you know. And we feel defensive. Because it's so logical in our culture that you think of yourself. And of course, having an ego, being who we are, ego-grasping beings who are preoccupied with I, necessarily, then it seems almost puzzling for us to think that somehow there's a mistake in being, in thinking about yourself. It seems bizarre to us. None of our psychological models would ever posit such a thing, you know. So it's very hard for us to hear this. And I might have mentioned last week, but I'll say it here now in this context, especially that we're now getting into the exchanging self for others steps of the 11 steps to accomplish bodhicitta. That as Pabongka Rinpoche says, you need to be a suitable vessel to hear these teachings. And what that means is, if you haven't done the initial stages of practice, junior school and high school, if you haven't put yourself together and controlled your own body and speech and looked at your mind and seen your attachment and seen your anger and seen your depression and seen your jealousy, if you haven't gotten past being a victim, because let's face it, that's what a victim is, we're all victims, hurt, offended, pain, suffering, then like I said, you know, you start going through the eight verses of mind training, this amazing text that's so often used by this great Tibetan Lungri Tangpa, one of the disciples of Drumtompa, who was a disciple of Atisha, who were the ones who really were the proponents of this amazing system of accomplishing bodhicitta, which in the beginning stages were kept secret because they were seen to be so outrageous. And this eight verses is the context in which this Tonglen technique, which is the one that you use that finally brings bodhicitta, which is coming in a minute, is from there. This is sort of part of that whole genre of practices in the Buddhist literature. That if you hear that, like the first verse, you know, of that eight verses I mentioned, I think last week, where it says, when you with others see yourself as the lowest of all. And the next line says, and see others as supreme. If you still haven't heard much Buddhism and you're still miserable and unhappy and living with a brutal husband who's abusing you and you hear this, this is not for you, baby. This is why we don't think of levels when it comes to love and compassion. We just think it's just a nice thing to have and we all should have it. But it's kind of heavy duty to hear that. That's you know, don't give that to anybody. See yourself as the lowest of all and see others as supreme. You need to be a suitable vessel to hear those words correctly. And that can include some of us in this room right now in different situations in our lives. It's a highly developed practice. It's outrageous. It already demands that you've got certain realizations. This is why they said they kept it secret, these practices. They sound so cute and simple. They're outrageous. If it's emptiness, it's sort of thing we put our intelligent hat on. You know, wow, that's difficult. But this, we can't think that love and compassion is difficult. This is outrageous stuff. See yourself as the lowest of all. So who's the person who's qualified to do that? Is the person who's seen their mind, controlled their body, controlled their speech, knows that they are the cause of their own suffering, knows that they are the cause of their own happiness, doesn't want to harm others because they can't bear another thought of their own suffering, has got real renunciation, real self-respect, has really grown up. That's the person who then and has some strong sense of emptiness. That's the person who can hear the benefit of this practice, of when you're with others, you see yourself as the lowest of all. It's outrageous. Most of us probably aren't even at that level. I mean it seriously. Right now, we already see ourselves the lowest of all when we're feeling miserable. So we think, what on earth are you on about? I already see myself as the lowest of all. What do you want me to do? Grovel in myself, you know? It doesn't make sense to us. We already have so much self-pity. We're not really ready for this, you know. We can try it once a month. Be brave, you know. Because what we're trying to do in all these practices is make this unbelievable paradigm shift to actually, when we finally achieved it, a person who's got this is a person who's just full of bliss and love for all sentient beings, like a mother for her precious child. If you've got a precious being in your life, think of how you love this person. Your heart is open when you think of this person, especially babies, you know. People just absolutely adore the feeling of bliss. You hear the number of parents who say their life has changed. I'm talking about it. It's amazing. That's how bodhisattvas feel about all sentient beings. I mean, it's inconceivable, you know. And this is a practice to get there. The practice, and there's eight verses, you know, one of these ways of this, one of the many texts in this type of practice. To see, so it's the first verse. And giving, we went through it, didn't we? The eight verses. We did, didn't we? Didn't we go through the eight verses? You don't remember? I didn't. Maybe it was in Boston. I forget. Maybe it was in New York. We didn't do it. I think we should. And it gets us Tonglen anyway. It gets us to Tonglen, which is the point. Okay, let's find the eight verses. Who's got... Can someone find me the eight verses? I haven't got it here. In a book somewhere? In a book. No? Didn't put it in the text. It's easy if I just read the words. Thank you. Leave it there. It's okay. Golden light. No, no, no. We'll just go through those. And it culminates in the practice of Tonglen. The last practice is the one of Tonglen, which is the one that is the fifth and ninth, I think. I forget. Where's Tonglen come, Dion? The actual giving and taking. There's two steps, isn't it? Numbers which and which? And then the next one? And that's six? And that's seven? Eight? Oh, yeah, that's eight and nine. And then that's all or something. Oh, and then bodhicitta. Oh, okay. Well, eight and nine, that's where you do Tonglen, giving and taking. And this text, this is where it came from, this one by Lungri Tungpa, this Tibetan. This practice of Tonglen came out of this, the tradition of this verse. And we find it. Okay. Okay. We'll get it. We're coming. Okay. So... If we keep going on these, so we, you know, you first try to use the logic of how others are equal as you, and that's how. So you think about how you, where do you practice this? Well, you practice it on the freeway. You practice it when your hubby gets annoyed with you. You practice it when the person's mean to you in the shop. You practice it 1,000 times a day. You know. Oh, I see. Okay. What's this? It's Lama Chirpa.
It's an empty.
Oh, the book. You've got it. Okay, fine. Completing. Okay, where is it?
Page 149.
The eight verses. Here we go. So tell...
Jill.
Huh? Who went out?
Jill.
We got... what have you got? We got it, sweetie. I found one. John's got it. Okay. Okay. So let's just go to the eight verses. Okay. So the first one says, determined to obtain the greatest possible benefit from all sentient beings, who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel, I'll hold them most dear at all times. This is verse 1. Already it's over the top. So what does it mean to obtain the greatest benefit from all sentient beings? It sounds very peculiar to us. It sounds like you're going to use them. And this is the same when they talk about in the second of the four opponent powers, where we rely upon suffering sentient beings. All it means is, if you want to cultivate compassion, compassion is defined as the wish that others don't suffer. So if you want to cultivate this compassion, who do you need? You need sentient beings who are suffering. You need to have them. You need to be around them. You need to see them. You need to hear about them. This is why, if you want to go to the mountains, that's junior school and high school. Bodhisattvas come down to the city. They come down and live around the suffering because that's grist for their mill. But we've got to be, again, a suitable vessel even for this. To be around too much suffering sending means can make us insane if we're not ready. But this is exactly what the body is. If we're trying to cultivate bodhicitta, we need to be around suffering sentient beings because that's how we see about suffering. You need to hear about it, read the papers, watch the television. Whereas we often think, I can't bear to see it. But this is how we get bodhicitta. This is why they talk about the brave bodhisattvas, you know. Because if you can't see suffering sentient beings, how can you have compassion? You cannot. Impossible. So, in order determined to obtain the greatest possible benefit from all sentient beings, this very first verse says, and already over the top, already insane, all sentient beings who are more precious than the wish-fulfilling jewel, more precious, precious. I mean, already that's ridiculous, isn't it? Your babies may be precious. Your husband's precious sometimes. The enemy is absolutely the opposite to precious, and all the rest, 99.99999% of the strangers couldn't care less, they could all drop dead. So they're all precious. I'll hold them most dear at all times. Verse 1. And they get more difficult as they go. So verse 2 is the one I said before. When you're with others, see yourself as the lowest of all, and see others as supreme. All of this is leading us to this outrageous view, this is the point, of actually exchanging self for others, which means just like a mother for her precious children, everyone will be like that for you, spontaneously, naturally, when you've actually accomplished this. And all these seemingly simple ways of thinking are the stages that the great meditators go through. People spend years in meditation on this stuff, you know, internalizing it ever more deeply. And of course, it's like this atomic bomb. It's like a nuclear bomb on self-cherishing, selfishness, attachment, ego grasping. Profound. So I remember Lama Zopa saying, even just one kind thought is incredible. And of course the point is that because we are so stressed, life is so difficult, there are so many people. It's incredibly hard, you know. So we haven't done any work on ourselves, you're going to drown. Forget it. And then that's why we harm each other. That's why people go beyond the level of stress that they can bear. And that's why I want to keep quoting, not joking. 40% of all murders of women are in partnerships. The husband usually, whatever. Partners, loved ones, in the domestic, in the loved ones, so-called. This just for me is beyond heartbreaking. Because it shows the despair of our minds, our utter inability to know ourselves. And so all the attachment, all the fantasy, all the drama, all the expectations, and then all the hurt, the pain, the grief, the loss, the rage, the jealousy, it is beyond bearing. Because we don't look at our minds. So this is so courageous to be around these maniacs called sentient beings. I mean, really? And then learn to love them, you know. This is just so outrageous stuff. God almighty. Anyway, the next one says, vigilant. This is really hilarious, this one. This indicates, this proves this is written for highly realized beings already. Honestly, it does. No wonder they kept it secret. Vigilant. The moment a delusion appears in my mind. The implication being that virtue is the default mode. And then every now and again a naughty delusion pops up. So that clearly is speaking to highly evolved beings already, right? Endangering myself and others, I will confront it and avert it without delay. Sounds so simple. Just check your mind, you know. So already it's assumed the moment a delusion arises in my mind, which means an attachment thought, a jealous thought, a depressed thought, an unhappy thought, a not fair thought, a poor me thought, an aversion thought, an irritated thought, an upset thought. Forget about raging, angry, proud, out of your brain, psychotic thought. It's an ordinary poor me, unhappy, depressed, jealous, not fair, angry, how dare you do it to me thought. Okay? Get the point. So, we do our best, you know. You see, our trouble too, because we're not so conscious of our mind. We don't notice our thoughts until they're vomiting out the mouth, you know, and the damage is done. So this is where way to go. Way to go. Way to go, baby. Way to go. I mean, the miracle of this, and this is the thing too, to even know back in junior school and high school, the levels to which we can develop our minds is way beyond what we could even conceive as possible in our psychological world. Because in our psychological models, having an uncontrolled mind is considered completely normal. You know? Whereas Buddha's view, the levels to which we can harness it and control it and transform it is just beyond imagination. That's why we like to put it into the level of spiritual. It just seems too insane, you know. They say when you've got single point of concentration, and Buddha says we've had this countless lives, but we keep losing it because we don't realize emptiness. One of the consequences of single point of concentration, which itself for most of us is unbelievable and we won't get it in this life maybe, is that, this is where it's impossible to believe, first you'll be blissful, and you'll have absolute control over all your thoughts. There's no such thing as an uncontrolled thought. You're not finished delusioned yet, but there's such incredible control over your mind because it's, you're aware of your mind, not like control, like tight and intense, like fearful, but effortless, because your mind is so clear, so and able, and you've done such subduing of your mind. And this really is, in terms of real realizations, is the first step, you know. So, we do our best to catch our thoughts as they are rising, the chaos, and attempt to hear them, and attempt to avert them, if we can. But the why it's so hard to avert them is because we don't notice them until it's Vesuvius about to explode. That's why it's so hard. You know, the best thing we say is, I mean, if I'm in the middle of a fight with somebody, what can I do? Not much. It's too late. It's like too late. Really, it's too late. But that's our tragedy, because we don't have techniques in our culture to notice our thoughts until it's too late. That's all we don't know, that we can go down much deeper and see them and hear them well before they explode into emotion, you know. That's our trouble. So having, you know, in the grades of practice, this is university here, in junior school, in high school we learn ideally to do the one of concentration, meditation, which, and we might not even in this life get concentration, but we begin this miraculous job of waking up to what's going on in our head as opposed to only seeing what's going on out there. As Lama Zopa says, most people in the world don't even know that their mind plays any role at all. So this is already miraculous. The ownership of what's happening in our mind is incredible. And we keep increasing this power, you know. And so here it's implied hugely. The moment a delusion arises, you, endangering, this is the attitude you need to have for it, seeing it as like a poison. It's like you ate poison. And look at the care, you know, the same care that we use if we have some food allergies. The same care we use to read every label, every single thing, was no way in the universe we're going to eat a thing that's even tainted by the smell of a peanut. That level of awareness, that level of endangering myself. That one, but about our thoughts. Already you can see it's a stupendous level of awareness and renunciation and understanding, you know. But endangering yourself and others. I will avert it. You know, I will avert it instantly. It's an incredible level of practice. Unbelievable. All you can do is aspire to it. Where is it? Now I've lost it. Here we go. Next one. You know, whenever I see, they say all these words, old-fashioned words like wicked. Who uses wicked except for in Broadway plays, you know? Whenever I see evil people, what's the word we use for naughty, naughty, naughty people? What's the word we use? Psychos. What do we say? What are the words? No, that jerk's pathetic. That's just an unfair person. I mean, real evil being. So what do we call, what are the words we use in our culture these days? Thank you. Sociopaths. Thank you. Whenever I see sociopaths, evil beings. I mean, who uses that? Wicked in nature. We don't talk like that. It's sort of like, you know, jerks. Whenever we see sociopaths overwhelmed by violent negative actions and suffering, that's better, we get it, I'll hold them as rare dear ones, as if I had found a precious treasure. So it's like these words are dangerous. You don't say them to normal people. If people have come here for the first time tonight, anybody come here for the first time tonight? Oh my goodness. I'm sort of joking, but are you kind of hear what I'm saying here? These are dangerous words. I mean, you'd come sue me. Okay, well, I should give context to this, and if you're here for the first time, my God. Does it sound weird what I'm saying? Someone who's been here, who's here for the first time, is it weird what I'm saying? Be very sincere. Am I sounding weird? Are you kind of getting an inkling of what I'm talking about? Okay. Thank you. You? You're not having a mental breakdown? Gosh. You see, okay, I better give context. We're just reminding all of us. You know, especially the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, there's this really strong emphasis on all the practices and teachings which are coming right back to the Buddha presented in a nice, orderly, structured way, which is the way we learn anything, you know, rather than sort of cross your fingers and cross your legs and cross your eyes and God knows what and hope to have some nice vision, which is how we tend to have cliched ideas of meditation, you know. And so the compassion, they talk about a bird needs two wings, wisdom and compassion. And like I'm saying before, love and compassion sound nice. But the more we look into the way that this tradition is looking at the cultivation of love and compassion, it means love and compassion for every single sentient being. And that's like, on the face of it, insane. So there's all the, you know, like I said, this is sort of the university level, really, if you think of it that way, using these concepts. Then all the previous work of the so-called wisdom wing is all the work in Buddhist terms that you do on yourself, knowing your own mind, controlling yourself, understanding your own self, having accountability, growing up, being brave, looking at yourself, taking responsibility, and knowing you can change yourself, you know, lessening your own fears, your own dramas, your own attachment, your own depression, which is much of what Buddhist practice is, really knowing your mind, becoming your own therapist, you know. Which is a massive job. So what I said before, you know, about the business of you're still a victim, this is, you've got to be a suitable vessel for this, is really true. If you're still in the midst of feeling chaotic and miserable and depressed and low self-esteem, this is not practices for us, you know. And like I said, most of us are this anyway. We feel miserable one day, depressed, feel that I'm the worst person, so this really is like high teachings. But it's sort of, and I said in Tibet, this is back in the 8th century, these texts were kept secret because it seems like so outrageous. And it's surprising to us to hear that teachings about love and compassion can be seen as secret. It sounds weird, you know, because it's so dramatic. And what they're aiming for, this practice of what they call the Sanskrit word bodhicitta. It's a Sanskrit word, and it's referring to this very highly developed, extraordinary attitude, which many people go off for years and years and years in retreat to get, developing this love and compassion for every single sentient being without exception, and then truly dedicating your life to want to help them, and then, of course, for the Buddha, life after life after life, dedicated to want to help sentient beings, because they're all suffering. All the psychopaths, all the misery, all the terrorists, all the pedophiles, all the horrible ex-husbands, all the mean boyfriends, all the horrible next-door neighbors, you know, whatever it might be. That Buddha's saying we're all caught up in suffering. We're all caught up in ego grasping and the fears and the attachment and the jealousy, depression. And so the first stage is to get to see this in ourselves. Then we can see this is why we're suffering, and then we can see others, why they're suffering. It really is more advanced. And that's why in the earlier stages of practice, when we see ourselves and we're in a miserable relationship, a horrible boss, a horrible boyfriend, and we're being bullied and victimized, and we feel sorry for ourselves and have all this frustrated, sort of internalized anger, the thing we must do is become strong and clear and not just put up with rubbish, which is what we do when we're scared and victims, but say, thank you, excuse me, I'm leaving, bye-bye, you know. Have courage. And this is something we don't have. The irony of ego, the way Buddhism talks, the irony of ego is that it's self-pity, is that we're paralyzed with fear, don't see ourselves, can't see our good qualities. All we do is see our negative qualities. We're addicted to our own misery, you know. And this is all the work we do in the wisdom wing. This is a really full-on, intense, internal work we need to do to become these really brave, courageous people who then can be around crazy sentient beings and realize they're all suffering, just like me. But because we've developed ourselves to a certain degree, we can actually now be able to help others. So these are the simple verses, which people go often, I mean, Kirti Sentam Rinpoche, one of our lamas, went off at years, 7 years of retreat on these types of things, going really deep into this, until eventually they do, this term they use, exchange self for others, when truly others are like a mother for her child, they say. But like I'm saying, in normal ordinary world, this is madness, you know, but this is what the Buddhist view is saying we can accomplish in the long term. these next two are really getting close to home, and I think in our own ways, each one of us can see some kind of advantage to these, and it's kind of, I'll speak about them simply, you know. This is where we're seeing, especially if we've been mistreated by others, and we all are mistreated at some point by somebody, you know. And the usual response, if we're really caught up in misery and self-pity and the ego, which is how we all are, it's so painful. To be accused, for example, of doing something you didn't do is beyond bearing. It really is beyond bearing, isn't it? Enough to make us crazy. So one of these really powerful practices, if we can be brave enough, if we're ready for it, is, as we'd say, you take the blame. I'll never forget one story. I love this story as an example, you know. This friend in Sydney, a Buddhist, John, was having a party. His Buddhist friends were there, so some of my friends were there. And so John said, he was telling everybody how his brand new BMW, he discovered with a big scratch right along the doors. So he got the new, didn't know who did it, but he bought new doors and everything, cost him a few thousand, you know. Then he discovered it's been done again. So he doesn't know what to do, and he discovers it's the mad old bloke next door, this fellow, whatever he's thinking John has done wrong, God knows, he's a bit of a psycho, must be. So he scratches his door, so John doesn't know what to do. He's a very reasonable fellow, nice man. So he said, what do you think I should do, you know? Well, you can scratch his car, you can sue him, whatever. But then one of the people, George, who's there, said, well, I'll tell you what Lama Zopa would do. Lama Zopa is, you know, the spiritual director of this center and this organization, my teacher. He said, well, I'll tell you what Lama Zopa would do. He would discover what this old bloke really liked. And he would buy him a beautiful gift, and he would apologize to him. Hear my words, okay? So he thought this was great. He liked it. He liked this idea. So, of course, we take the bigger picture here. And as you know, Buddhism talks about karma. And karma means we've got past karmic relationships with people. And we've got this history with everyone. We keep bumping into each other again, friends, enemies, and strangers all the time. Keeping giving back what we've given in the past. And then blaming and the rubbish continuing. So this is a very strong view for the Buddhists. We've all got this karmic history with each other. And so, you know, given that we've got this history with each other, we have to deduce, if we have the view of karma, that we must have harmed this guy in the past. So John having this view, then he heard, then he thought, okay, this is a good idea, I'll do that. So he discovered this old bloke liked golf, and he bought him these beautiful fancy golf balls, wrapped them beautifully, went next door, knocked on the door, and the old bloke shocked to see him, you know. And he offered him the gift, and he apologized for anything he'd done wrong. So then he went home, he felt quite happy, he thought he'd finished it, you know, John did, he was very pleased. And the old bloke comes in, knocks on the door, beaming from ear to ear with his gift unwrapped, and he says to John, this is amazing, it's the kindest thing anybody's done. He said, everything's forgiven. I mean, you've got to be brave to do that. Did you get that story? Did you get it? You didn't get it? You did. I mean, it's ridiculous, isn't it? Who would do that? I mean, you hear all these stories of next-door neighbours. I remember one, you know, these big conflicts between next-door neighbours. One that began with the trash can being a foot over to the wrong side. And 27 years later, there's hundreds of thousands of dollars of suing. There's big spotlights. There's big music. There's tunnels underneath. There's, like, to never give up on blaming each other. I mean, you get my point. He goes and apologises and the whole thing's over. I mean, excuse me. That's pretty brave. You've got to admit. But it worked, you know. It was amazing, wasn't it? That's intense. I mean, that's really brave. You've got to admit. That's incredible. Well, that's called taking the blame. Now, look how we are. Even when you did do something wrong, it's unbearable to take the blame, you know. I mean, it's beyond bearing. So this points to the depth of ego, the depth of the instinct to grasp at this I and defend, you know. It's so primordial in us. That's why this stuff is so outrageous, because it's completely opposite to normal. I mean, it's opposite to normal. Your new BMW's been scratched. It's not just your trash can over the thing, you know. My God, amazing. Everything is forgiven, he says. I mean, that's amazing, guys, to even dare to do that, you know, isn't it? That's incredible. So brave. So maybe once a year you try that one. Every 10 years. Take the blame. It's incredible. And, of course, one of the verses here is like, you know, is especially when it really comes close to home. And this is the one when you hear about, you know, people, partners, beloveds, husbands and wives. And then he gives you up for a younger version 30 years later, out of the blue. I mean, I can't even think of the pain of that. And it's so common, isn't it? You've given your life. You've sacrificed your life to this person. Give them every tiny secret. There's nothing left that they haven't known about you. And then overnight they leave you. I can't even say the words. It's just too much to bear, you know. But to see that as the most precious person. That's the one. That's like ridiculous. I can't even say these words. I'm sorry. It's too ridiculous. I'd rather talk about emptiness. It's easier. Okay? Next week. Oh, this week. This is this week already, isn't it? We're in this week, aren't we? Oh, my God. Soon it'll be gone, you know. Anyway, love and compassion. Oh, my God. So, anyway, let me just talk about Tonglen. It feels like it's not easy, but it's easy. So, it all leads to this practice. All these techniques go up to this practice that's called Tonglen, giving and taking in Tibetan. Very simple, giving, taking. And it's itself a technically easy practice, and lots of people, it's wonderful, love to do it. It's really powerful. But it sometimes can be misunderstood, you know. So I'll explain it very briefly. Basically, you start with visualizing in front of you a person whom you adore, you know, who's got a headache or something. And the whole practice, there's a multitude of ways you can do it. There's a simple way to do it by using your breath. So you visualize this person with a headache. And this means you've got compassion for them. Compassion is meaning you see their suffering and you have empathy with it. And you don't want them to suffer. That's why it's easy to have compassion for a beloved. So visualize a beloved, your beautiful baby or your best friend or your dearest, whatever it might be, you know. And you see their suffering. That's compassion. That's compassion. Feeling empathy with their pain, wishing they didn't have it. Then the first thing is, when you breathe in, so you visualize breathing in like yucky smoke, their suffering. Literally taking off them their suffering and breathing it in to yourself. Taking upon yourself their suffering. This is opposite to normal as well, but hear the point. So there's a way of doing this, is visualize a little rock at your heart, which is your self-centeredness, you know. So you breathe in this yucky smoke, and you're breathing it in as if you're taking upon yourself their suffering. So that is something we understand. We hear about parents all the time. Rather me than them, they'd say. People say this, you know. Even like, you know, I worked with people in prison for many years, and one person in prison, this maniac, the one who put his friend's heads down the toilet, remember that one? The guy, the crazy Mexican gangster. And he's becoming a Buddhist now. So he, you know, he's in prison for life, he won't get out. And he said, when he sees all his people coming and these young kids of 15 and 16 being tried as adults now, it's so terrible, you know. He says, when I see my people, the young ones coming in, I'm in prison anyway, I wish I could take upon myself their sentence and they can go, he said. That's outrageous thought, isn't it? Incredible. But mothers and fathers have that for their babies. You hear about that. Rather me than them. That's exactly the attitude here in this practice of giving and taking. This one. Of course, you just meditate. You're just imagining it. So then you finish. When you breathe, you breathe in yucky smoke. You imagine taking off this person. First start with your beloved. You're going to eventually graduate to enemies when you're really brave. Start with your beloved. That's already fantastic. You breathe in the suffering. And then when you breathe out blissful light, and you imagine giving, so taking and giving them your happiness, your health, your wealth, your virtue, whatever you want, you know. So it's an outrageous idea, but it can be done in this contained way, and lots of people love this practice, which I think is amazing. But let me explain, because sometimes there's a misunderstanding about it. Often we think it's a healing practice. It's not a healing practice. It's not meant to be a method to heal your beloved's headache. Well, technically, all it is you imagining a person who's got suffering and imagining if you could, you would take upon yourself their suffering because you would rather have the pain than them. This is the business of so-called exchanging self for others. And instead of cherishing me most, we're practicing actually cherishing the other person more. That's what the practice is. So people like this practice very much. It's very brave. It's very amazing. You know? So the point about it, though, is not to get a headache. You're not thinking, I've got to get a headache, and that's the proof that I just was successful. And that's not the point at all, I promise. And it's not a healing technique. All it is like a practice for you to become brave in the development of compassion and love. Because the taking upon yourself their suffering, imagining it, if I could, I would, rather me than them, is the practice of compassion. And then the practice of giving your happiness is the practice of love. Because compassion is the thought, the Buddhist interpretation, the definition. You see a person suffering and you wish they didn't have it. It's empathy with someone suffering. Then you've got love, which is you see them happy and you delight in their happiness. You want them to be happy. That's the meaning of love. Of course, what we're trying to do here in these techniques is grow these to an incredible degree, where eventually, with this practice, and this Tonglen is the key practice. People often, again, like do it for years, you know, until eventually, not just thinking of your beloveds, but all the enemies, all the friends, all the strangers, you actually deepen and deepen and deepen this until eventually becomes genuine realizations of exchanging self for others, you know. So there's a particular level of compassion and love here. They talk about, like Dian mentioned it, great love, great compassion. This sounds a bit strange. But normal compassion, ordinary compassion, which is pretty stupendous already, is you see someone suffering, and we all have this, you see someone suffering and you feel their pain. You cry, you're sad, you feel, oh my God, that's terrible, that's suffering. You know, whether it's your friend, you read about it, it makes us sad to see the suffering in the world. That's compassion. That's compassion. Fantastic. But then the trouble is, what this great compassion is a very specific, like, next level that we need to cultivate, which is the one that gets us to eventually become this outrageous being called a bodhisattva, who's got phenomenal love and compassion, who has truly exchanged themselves for others. And what this great compassion is, so there you go, you see the headache, oh my God, that's terrible, you have compassion. But then you go, what can I do to take it away? What can I do to help? That's great compassion. And that's the one that's really powerful. Because it's you taking responsibility to take action. And this is where we get very confused when we see the suffering of the world. One of our commonest responses is we get angry at who did it. We have compassion for the dog, we want to find the person who harmed them so we can be mad at them. We have compassion for the child, we get mad at the person who harmed them. We have compassion for that group, and we get mad at this group who dropped the bombs on them. So the compassion is fine, but then what happens is we want to find someone to blame, and it turns into anger or despair. And we don't know what to do. This is the problem. So we've got to leave it at the level of compassion, and then, just like Martin Luther King said, I love this. It's so profound, actually. He said, it's all right to be angry, meaning it's all right to see suffering. You've got to see suffering. That's called intelligence. You can't pretend there's no suffering. But there's no, you know, instead of just getting raging angry and shouting and yelling and cursing, that doesn't do any good at all. You see suffering and then you say, he said this, what can I do about it? That's when it becomes action. And that's really profound. And that's the courage of the bodhisattva. What can I do? It's like, as they say, it's the personal responsibility. His Holiness the Dalai Lama used to call it universal responsibility. Not just, oh my God, the world's so suffering, get on with your own, you know? Or not just to despair either, or get angry, that's not much help. Getting depressed doesn't help. Getting angry doesn't help. Seeing it, realizing the suffering, and of course the more you do the earlier stages of practice, the more you realize your own suffering and its causes, karma and delusions, then you have such deep compassion and empathy for others and the pain that they are all experiencing, including the uglies, including the psychos, which sounds so weird. But let's face it, it's logical. Anyone who harms another has to be intensely suffering. But our problem is, you see, when we say suffering, we mean a very narrow group of people. We only mean the animals, the children, and the poor victims. But this view of suffering the Buddha's taking is a much broader view. It means anybody who's caught up in delusions, who's neurotic, who's raging, who's angry, who harms others. The real point the Buddha's making is you have compassion for those who harm others because they're harming themselves. And as we know with the Buddhist view of karma, everything we do, we're going to get the consequences, goodness or badness. So that's the tragedy of others harming others and the basis of compassion for them. This takes time. This is huge. You know, this is massive. slowly, slowly we move towards this, you know. So this level of compassion is not easy. My goodness. It's huge. One step at a time. Got to be a suitable vessel, you know. So would you like to ask me some questions? Sure. Okay. Yes.
Okay. This bodhicitta stuff is tough stuff. I don't
That's
know
right.
if there's this much.
I thought
when I was left Christianity, I was coming on a vacation.
Huh?
I thought when I left Christianity, I was coming on a vacation, but this is rough. What is wrong with just being a good person? Respect everyone.
Uh-huh.
Help everyone.
But isn't that what
we're
saying?
Don't hurt anyone.
But then you really mean this. Being a good person, helping everyone, is what we're saying here. That includes the psychos. But we don't usually mean the psychos. We don't think we're supposed to be kind and loving to them. So it's easy to say the words. But it's another, you know, we're spelling it out here. The methods of how to get to that point. It sounds easy. Well, you see, that's the point. We see a person, like if, you know, anyone who's seen the Dalai Lama, even if you're not a Buddhist, if you see the Dalai Lama, you read about the Dalai Lama, he just seems like a nice guy. He cracks jokes about Mao Tse-tung and his enemies. He cries with compassion for his suffering people. He cries with compassion when he talks about his mummy who died. He seems like a really nice, friendly guy. This Pope seems to me like that, too. He's down to earth, funny. He just seems like a nice chap. And this is the interesting point. They say a really developed spiritual practitioner who's done all the work on emptiness and been a great meditator, in the end, they end up just looking like a nice person, just the person you said. But to get to that, beyond ego and fears and attachment and grasping and enemies and friends and strangers, it's like this war zone you have to get through to come out the other end to be the nice person who's happy and friendly and loves everybody. Sounds so cute. But to get there is beyond outrageous. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, that's why it looks easy. Whereas you think about emptiness, like I said, all these fancy teachings in the wisdom teachings in Buddhism, all about the nature of reality and how there's this and there's no self and blah, blah. It all sounds like, oh, get your intelligent hat on here. Oh, I like this. But love and compassion, just like you said, be a nice person, like everybody. It's not like it. Come on. Excuse me. You know? Whew, look at the world. Everywhere we turn, every culture you turn to, there's going to be the groups of people harming each other historically. Unbelievable suffering and pain. To love everybody, sounds so simple. God. You get my point, don't you?
Yeah.
Whew, one step at a time. And that's why it's corny to say it. And that's why the wisdom wing is where you do the work on yourself. You've got to learn. We like to say that in the West, and there's nothing wrong. We need to love and have compassion for ourselves first, which means stop attachment, stop anger, stop depression, stop fear, stop jealousy, which is what breaks our hearts and makes us miserable. And that's why we harm others. So when you've stopped that, already you're getting ahead of the game. Already you're a fantastic person. Already more stable. And that's massively hard work. Then that's the basis, though, for genuine love and compassion. Do you understand, isn't it? Tough stuff. Someone else? Yes. Okay. One second. Yes.
Thank you for being here.
Okay.
I have a question about attachment.
Yeah.
I think I heard you say that enjoying a chocolate cake was perfectly fine. Being attached to it is the problem.
Okay. Well, this is a new chapter, new part. This is part two. It's a separate discussion, isn't it? Just so we all know. Cancel discussion about bodhicitta. We'll go back to junior school. Okay? Fine. Perfect. So before that, give context. Okay.
So actually, that wasn't my question specifically.
Okay, what's your question then?
If I happen to, say I've been able to do that, enjoy chocolate cake without attachment, but I happen to enjoy chocolate cake more than carrot cake.
Uh-huh.
And what's the difference in my state of mind when I'm having chocolate cake versus carrot cake?
No, I understand you. Okay. When we talk, you know, Buddhist psychology, like we've been discussing, which we do in the earlier stages before all this, we learn to see that in the mind, we have the mental consciousness, the way Buddha talks. There's all these different states of mind. Lots and lots and lots and lots of different distinct states of mind. At the moment, it's like a big soup. We can't tell one bit from another, you know? Do you understand? And so what we have to do through learning to meditate, learning Buddhist psychology, begin to identify these different states of mind. So we know that one way of categorizing the contents of our mental consciousness is into negative, positive, and neutral states. So there's thousands of them all. So we know then we've got to narrow down the negative ones because they're the source of all suffering. They're the voices of ego. They're the drum. And they're called attachment, on the basis of which we get then angry, on the basis of which we have all the other dramas. Okay? So then we have a bunch of other states of mind. Every moment, like I said, we have pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, or neutral feeling. And a pleasant feeling is what we call happiness, moment by moment. Remember? Okay. So we know at the moment the logic of samsara, which is not logic at all, Buddha says, it's the way we live, you know, we got these wrong deductions. I see that brown triangle, I label it chocolate cake, I trigger my memory of having had it before, I trigger my memory of it having triggered a pleasant feeling. Completely valid. Nothing wrong with any of this. We're all sensory beings. We've all got the tongue. And we all happen to have an American or Australian way of doing. So it's the chocolate cake. Now, for a Tibetan, it would be a piece of yak cheese. Or Australian, it would be our Vegemite. So that's a cultural, it's habit, that's all. You get used to certain habits, your senses, you know. Or some people, like in Tibetans, will love their hot chili. Mexicans, they won't have anything without hot chili. In India, you know, you go even to the street vendors, you get your piece of fruit and it's got chili on it, you know. So it's all just culture. That's culture. So that as a result of that, your preference is chocolate cake instead of yak cheese. We then, of course, attachment comes into the mix, but it comes in a millisecond, and so we don't think it's a separate state of mind. But actually, it's a polluted, neurotic, disturbing, deluded state of mind that instantaneously over-exaggerates the deliciousness of the cake, over-exaggerates its role in triggering a pleasant feeling, and then we grasp at it and anticipate the happiness. And even as you're having the first mouthful, you're grasping at the second mouthful. So the pleasant feeling is just the pleasant feeling. But attachment is another state of mind altogether, but not so easy to see them as separate. In fact, it's only really advanced when you really have been your own therapist and really have begun to realize emptiness, that you actually not have the attachment. We can't even have just a mouthful of water now without grasping at it, over-exaggerating its role. So it's ever so subtle. So a pleasant feeling is totally valid. This is called happiness. But as we've been talking, the Buddhist psychological view, our misconception is, and this is what Buddha means by being in samsara, is an absolute default mode. We assume the only way to trigger a pleasant feeling in our mind, because it's a function of our mind, the only way we know how to trigger a pleasant feeling is to stick the cake in the hole. Or whichever object it is in whichever hole. Do you get my point? You get my point? That's the problem. And that's a default assumption in our minds primordially. We wouldn't even know if we simply didn't have any sensory experience in one day, we would go insane. Because the default mode for us being this sensory being, the only way we know how to trigger a good feeling is get a nice sense object. Do you see what I'm saying? But the Buddha says it's completely mistaken. And it's just hilarious. We can't even see it. But it's quite a subtle point. So way to go before you can have an object of the senses without being attached to it. But at least we can begin to be aware of the process and become our own therapist and observe it and harness the energy of it. Do you see?
I think so. It sounds like you're saying the idea of being able to enjoy a chocolate cake without attachment is kind of just an academic or intellectual exercise.
No!
For not ultimately, but for,
don't say like
as
that.
A That's, practical matter.
No, you can't say it that way. That's completely mistaken. Of course it's not intellectual, theoretical. It's totally our practice. But you've got to start somewhere. All I'm saying is don't hold your breath to get the realization of it.
It's like
learning to be Einstein. You've got to know the theories first, slowly, 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 and then slowly, slowly you can begin to observe your mind and even distinguish between a moment of pleasure and the attachment. We can do all that, but what I mean is to stop getting caught up in the habit of it. This really takes time.
Okay, yes, I think I do understand that. Assuming a person who was truly able to enjoy the chocolate cake without attachment.
That's right.
Is there there's a difference in their level of enjoyment of the carrot cake versus the...
Oh, my God. If there isn't, why bother trying? Okay, use my gross analogies as usual, the way we get pleasure now is like that wild pig. They have these planks. In some countries, like in Tibet, there's these planks with a space, and that's where you go to the toilet. You go to the bathroom. Well, I'll be more direct. They're waiting there with their mouths open for the hot shit, you know. That's the level of... If you want to compare... Our pleasure now is like that, as opposed to the pleasure of a mind that is naturally blissful, which is a mind gone beyond attachment. I'm not trying to make it sound holy or ridiculous. But it's the way Buddha put it, is the pleasure we have now is still pleasure, but it's totally polluted. If you want to look at a person who's really greedy, I'm not to be mean, watch them shove the cake in, shove the alcohol down. They're like an animal. I'm not being mean about animals. But it's uncontrolled, berserk. And you can say, listen, even when you're slightly hungry and you have your piece of I have my piece of toast, you don't remember you even had it. Because attachment dulls your mind, makes it frantic and craving, and we don't even remember. Here I am with my usual gross examples, but if you've ever been slightly drunk or stoned and had a very pleasant experience with your nice boyfriend, you wake up next day, you don't remember. Because the delusion, when you've really been, the senses have gone berserk, we're like just dull, you know. There's no awareness at all. The mind is like just grasping, frantic, like a vampire. Are we communicating?
I think so.
Thank you. So don't be moralistic about this and think, oh, you know, enjoying chocolate cake is naughty. That's not what's being said. It's just the Buddha would say, if we can just realize how primordially deep and how terribly painful and how it's the cause of all suffering is this attachment, which sounds to us so ridiculous. And as Lama Zopa says, you've got renunciation when just the thought of another moment of attachment is so disgusting, it's like being in a septic tank. Way to go, baby. I'm trying to make it sounds easy words, but I'm trying to show it's long term. But we've got to start now. This is what the practice is. Getting the awareness. And that's why you've got to first start learning the Buddha's psychological model, because his view of what attachment is and what pleasure is not how we define it in the materialist world at all. You better get your definitions clear and precisely what he means by this, which is a very precise understanding. You see what I'm saying? Okay. Someone else? Yes?
With what you were saying with the giving and taking,
yes,
I'm a little fuzzy on, I know it's a high-level practice, but
yes,
what happens to all of that, for lack of a better way of putting it, negative energy that you take
on?
Oh,
but you don't. That's the point. You don't. That's the point. You don't, darling. You don't. There's no negative energy. You don't. You don't take on negative energy. You don't. You don't. The point of this is it makes you infinitely courageous, it purifies your ego, and it causes you to have infinite love and compassion. It's like an atomic bomb on ego. So the ego is what goes. It's a technique to remove ego. It's a technique to become fearless in your wish to benefit others. You don't take on, that's my point, you're not taking on a headache. It's like a mother. I always remember watching one of these movies on the television years ago about all the outrageous things that mothers would do to save their babies. And this one woman ran into a burning house. Okay, I think she came out again. I don't remember. But what I'm getting at is, if she was sitting there thinking, you know, there's no self-consciousness, I'm running into a burning house, she was totally focused only on her baby. So she was beyond fear. The thought of being burned was irrelevant to her. She only wanted to save her baby. That's what we're trying to get to.
I'm just having a hard time separating the metaphor used of breathing in the oily black smoke. You know, you're taking...
You're missing the point. The mother was not rushing into a burning fire. Oh, I'm getting burned. I'm getting burned. She was saving her baby. Everything in her being was thinking of her baby. Everything in her being. So that's what the experience was. She was prepared even to die for her baby. So it's that courage that we're trying to cultivate. Where it's in the beginning, it's like a joke. We don't feel this. The point is, when you're breathing in the yuck, It's the one as if you were a mother and your most precious child, and all you're really noticing is, thank God this person is now free of suffering. So ordinary compassion is, oh my God, look at that suffering. Great compassion is, oh my God, what can I do? This one says, you know what, I'd rather have it, I'd rather you be free of it. You're only noticing the other person being free of it. It's not relevant, even if you did get a headache, which you wouldn't. It actually is, it's an atomic bomb on your ego. You're going to end up more blissful.
I think I understand it.
Good.
Thank you.
Okay, good. That's important. Someone at the back. You, sweetheart. Yes, at the back, please. At the back, please. Yes.
I think you partially answered my question there. When dealing with someone who is a sociopath or a psychopath and you want to help heal, per se, is there any way to protect from the violence that you, your bodily harm? You just accept?
No, darling, listen. The point is, even in this one I mentioned about the psychopath, I'm trying to crack the joke about it. What we're trying to do here, too, it's in our own mind. When we're trying to see others suffering, the people who cause suffering, and this is all where we learn this in the earlier stages of practice, where you learn to see what causes suffering. Anger, ego, maniac, jealousy, the pain, the hurt. That's why people harm each other, you know? So the point is we're talking here of just even thinking about crazy people, thinking about suffering people. And realizing how they are so suffering and how that is so precious for us. It makes us have compassion for them because they've caused their own suffering by their own crazy mind. So it's not as if they're beating you up. Okay, the greatest bodhisattvas, the great beings who are actually accomplishing all this, they'd rather live with a weird wacko person, a person who even doesn't like them because they're so courageous in their ability to smash ego. But all it means is when you look at the world and you hear about the crazies who are doing terrible things, instead of rage and anger, you'd realize that they are suffering. So I mean, for me, the really good example, you know, mothers have children who are psychos. Psychos have mothers, don't they? So I bet that mother has such compassion for her child, wouldn't she? Don't you think she would? Because she sees he's harming himself. That's the point. That's the reason to have compassion. So, you know, an ordinary person, keep out of their way, please. But in your heart, you realize why they're doing what they're doing. And, of course, that comes in the Buddhist teachings about ego and attachment and rage and karma and all this stuff, you know. So it's a pretty tough one, but you protect yourself from other people. My God, you know. We tend to think of compassion being all sort of sentimental. No, not like that. Not like that. So when you have brave, I mean, even mothers who have junk, I mean, I remember one, you know, mothers, I think of a person I know, she called the police on her son, put him in jail. Tough love. That's real compassion because it was wise to help that person. So compassion isn't just some sentimental feeling. It's seeing, you know, first of all, it's having compassion for the one with a headache. Then you extend it to the ones who are harming others, which is really heavy duty, because they're harming themselves. And the Buddhist teachings, of course, talk about life after life after life, you know. Do you see what I'm saying? But protect ourselves from other people, of course. No question about it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Hi. What about if they're a family member?
who's a psychopath?
Well,
psychopaths have families, so you know.
Forth.
Excuse me, the world is a suffering place.
Exactly. What kind of practice should we try to incorporate? For?
Is it a husband or is it a wife? Is it a child? I mean, give me a bit more reference here.
Stepfather.
Who's a wacko? An unhappy person.
He's always angry.
Okay.
He seems to be
all right.
Aggressive.
Okay.
So forth.
Okay. This is where it's really difficult when it's family, isn't it? Especially if it's the next door neighbor, you can close the door, you know? This is where, it's very tough. It's just different. It's according to it's like anything. If you had to play Nadal in tennis, well, it depends on where you're at before you say, how will I play him, you know? If you're best as good as Nadal, you'll be okay. But if you've just begun playing tennis, forget it. So it depends on how much practice a person's done. If you're still a miserable person yourself and unhappy and raging and fearful, and then, you know, maybe you've got to get out of the way. Leave. Goodbye. Leave your wife and her father. You see what I'm saying? You've got to know where you're at. It depends on where you're at. That has to be the answer, you know. So if a person, if you've chosen to be married to this person who happens to have a psycho father, and you see this father around all the time, this is where it's very tough. So if it is unbearable, that's what I'm saying here. We've got to be reasonable and realize, I can't bear this. I cannot bear this. If she doesn't want to leave too, then I'm going to have to leave. And I really mean that, but we often don't realize we've got that choice. We think, oh, I shouldn't do it and I wouldn't do it. And that's why we end up all being crazy and killing each other. But we've got to be reasonable and know where we're at, you know. But if we do have decided, this is my family, I do live with this person, it is her mother, her father, and we have to see him regularly. Is it once a month, once a day? You live with him? What's the story?
My mother married, and...
Oh, it's your stepfather. Sorry, your yeah. mother married, so he lives with her.
Correct.
But you don't live with them.
No.
Okay.
I kind of visit everyone.
Okay, good. Okay, now we've got the exact scenario. Okay. So you love your mum?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, honey, this is where your practice is. Your practice is, instead of the usual behind his back, criticized the whole time, people love to talk about each other in families, we never stop going blah, 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 which builds up the nightmare. So one of your practices, now this sounds very peculiar, never say bad words about him behind his back. You will find, if you do that for 1 week, it'll be miraculous, the change. Because we build up all the drama. I bet you talk about it to other people, right?
Not really much, but I really talk to myself more than anything.
Okay, so is she happy with him?
She loves him.
Okay, then. So you're not mad.
And he makes her happy.
Okay, well, then that's fine. So she has to make her choices. You honor her choices. So the point is, when you do go there, you decide, I'm going to go for an hour, for 2 hours, for a day, and I'm going to give myself to them, and I'm going to be kind to him. I'm going to be generous to him. I'm going to be loving to him. I'm going to listen to his things. I'm going to ask him how he is. You really make an effort to be good and kind to this man who is obviously suffering. Then you can leave. But when you go, don't go resisting it and thinking, I don't want to go, and then be resentful and mean and nasty while you're there. If you're going to go, choose you're going to go for your mummy's sake and be really kind to him, as if he were your best friend, regardless of how he responds. That's an amazing practice, and it'll make your mother so happy. And then you leave. So you know you've got a certain timeline. You can work yourself up to it, 1 hour, 3 hours, whatever it might be. The other one is we get resisting, we resent it, we get mad at him, we annoy, we talk behind backs. That just builds up the drama, you know.
Thank you.
And then you leave. Then it's okay, you know. And then you've done an amazing, good for yourself and good for him. Isn't it? Someone else. Yes, sweetheart. Yeah. 8:30 nearly. Yes.
This is maybe a compassion karma question.
Yeah.
Forget people.
Uh-huh.
So far from that, let's think about animals for a second,
yes.
The animal realm, because
yes.
We're talking about all sentient beings.
Yes, we are.
So let's think about the rats and the roaches and the spiders and all
uh-huh.
those things that...
Uh-huh. We like to kill.
Yes.
That's right.
Okay, so... from what I understand from a little bit of karma that I know,
yes.
If a roach enters my kitchen,
uh-huh.
karmic seeds have been planted that I'm going to have that interaction with that roach.
That's your roach, baby, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I understand. Okay. So if it's my intention to kill the roach,
uh-huh.
that's my bad karma. I understand that part. But... what I don't understand is the cleansing part of karma, the burning of karma for the roach.
For the okay. roaches. What do you mean?
So if it's the roach's karma to come into my kitchen for me to kill it, then am I not showing compassion for the roach by doing
okay.
the karmic intention?
It's
a little confusing to me.
No, I understand. There's two things going on. There's the roach with his own mind stream. Continuity of consciousness, and the roach is due to karma, born into a roach body, and due to karma with you, speaking simply, born into, living in your house. So, you know, there's the roach, got its own karma. So, of course, every time anything negative or unhappy happens to any sentient being, that's the finishing of those karmic seeds for that sentient being. So you could argue when the roach dies or it's killed, that's the finishing of that particular karma. That's fine. But that's not the issue for you. The separate issue for you is what's happening in your mind. So you are creating your karma every moment, and the roach is experiencing its karma every moment. But so, you put it this way, if you, say, were a highly realized being, You could see the mind of the roach. You knew that if it dies in 2 minutes, it purifies enough karma to be able to then die and be reborn as a human being and have a nice spiritual practice. Then not only did, you know, have you done something compassionate, you've been, not only are you wise, but you've done an immensely compassionate action for you. You just planted compassionate seeds. But if you kill the roach out of anger and aversion, even though the roach might benefit from that, you just create a negative in your mind. So it's what you're doing in your mind creates your karma, and what happens to the roach is their karma, and we happen to come together. So it's incidental that the roach might, you know, maybe you're this person and you're sitting there with your tape recorder on and the Dalai Lama's singing, doing some teachings, and the roach is hearing the Dalai Lama. It puts a karmic imprint, and as it dies, it becomes a Buddhist and becomes a Dalai Lama student. Not inconceivable. Well, then you did a great service to the roach. But if you wanted to harm it out of bitterness and anger, I'm sorry, you get no benefit at all. Because you just wanted to harm it, and that's the karma for you. It's the wanting to harm is makes your action negative, not the result for the roach.
Okay.
You
okay.
See?
I do. Thank you. It's my my intention.
Your motivation, the reason behind it. Yeah, okay. Exactly. That's the key. Even you could argue the other way. Let's say there's a roach in your kitchen and you have compassion for the roach because you see it's hurt. You really have compassion. And like a lot of people, you assume killing it will help the roach. Do you understand? Euthanasia for roaches. Okay. So let's say you really have compassion and you kill the roach. Now, that roach could have heavy negative karma, could be full of grief and anger when it died, and could get a much worse rebirth. But you created good karma. Do you see what I'm saying? So the other scenario was it got a good rebirth, but you created heavy negative karma. This scenario is you created good karma because you meant well, but you had zero wisdom, and it went from the frying pan into the fire. Do you see my point?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Yeah. So you've got to have wisdom, honey, before you do anything to sentient beings. You know?
Long way to go.
Anyone else? Uh-huh.
Hi. So, I was wondering about if there's a perspective on daydreaming in Buddhism. So,
daydreaming,
yeah. So,
yeah, you look like a daydreamer.
Thank you. I've heard that before.
Daydreaming means just thinking about this and that and not really knowing what you're doing.
Yeah.
Or is it having detailed fantasies about your latest girlfriend? What's daydreaming?
Sure, sure.
Which one?
So the one I was thinking about specifically is that, when you've got kind of a daunting project or task ahead and you're kind of just feeling paralyzed and like, I can't do this, and then
okay.
You kind of start daydreaming, kind of build yourself up, but you're sort of encouraging your ego to sort of get you up off the ground and running in order to kind of tackle
it. Why should just encouraging yourself be called encouraging your ego? That sounds very cruel. We've got to encourage ourselves. We've got to be optimistic. We've got to know we can do it. But just being all hyper, that's just silly. That's not daydreaming. That's not daydreaming, sweetheart. That's being very intelligent. If you're sitting there being, oh my God, I can't handle this. And then you say, I can handle it. I can do it. Not sort of hopeful crossing your fingers, but being optimistic and kind to yourself. That's not daydreaming. That's intelligent. What's wrong with giving yourself encouragement?
Well, I guess sometimes I get just so distracted by the encouragement instead of actually doing.
You get what?
So, just wind up daydreaming about, oh, this is already done, and sort of give myself the credit for it being done and just sort of, you know.
That's called delusion, baby. That's called delusional. You've got to be practical. Is that? I think he's confessing
yeah.
his delusions. Is that really
yeah.
a problem for you? You really don't. Come on, I don't believe you do that. Don't be silly.
Okay. Well, I guess. fine. Then I'll just ask a related question, and I apologize. This isn't
okay, go on.
Clearly. So what about just run-of-the-mill daydreaming? When you're just sort of idly.
So what do you mean by that?
Sweetie? Sure. So what I mean by that is just kind of idly letting your mind float from thing to thing. You're not really.
That's called following attachment, which
okay.
is how we spend all our days. And when it's very strong, you're frantic to find a lovely memory. And then you're very strong, you're frantic. You can't stop thinking about ugly things, which is how we either aversion or attachment about the past and the future. That's 99% of what we do all the time and why we go mad. So it's recommended to harness your mind, to control your mind. And this is where it sounds so strange to us because we give such power to what we call our unconscious. We think there's some immense virtue in just sort of deciding, oh, what's in my mind, so seeing what pops up, you know? We think there's something special about that, like some special Pandora's box in there that we're dying to discover. Well, the Buddha says it's just ridiculous. There's junk. I mean, he leaves Jung's subconscious for dead. There's masses of stuff in there. And as we keep practicing, which is to learn to develop some awareness of what we're thinking and saying every day, then as we keep getting more and more awareness, we're going to uncover more and more junk. It's inevitable. Darling, if you've got a mind that's full of love and kindness and wisdom and contentment and fulfillment and joy and compassion and generosity, you do not have a problem. If it isn't that, it's attachment and fears and depression and low self-esteem and worries and just sort of bloody, bloody, blah, which is, can only drag us down. And it seems so shocking for us to hear this because it seems so like you're not allowed to do anything, you know. But it's all we're indicating is that the Buddha is indicating is a level to which we can develop our minds in clarity and wisdom and compassion and virtue.
Okay.
And you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and so when you catch yourself daydreaming, any one of those kind of negative things, what do you do to sort of acknowledge it and stop
What's your
it?
Name? What's your name?
Tim.
You say, shut up, Tim. Be quiet. Get on with it.
I said that before.
Back to the job. You just get back to the job at hand, you know? There's nothing wrong with relaxing. Put your feet out, put your feet up, relax, look at the sky. You know, but do something useful as well. The Buddhists would do, we'd just like do a mantra or something, make it useful. And relax your mind. I mean, the only time we ever seem to relax is when we sleep, and even then our dreams are so violent and weird, and wake up exhausted, you know, because our minds never stop. So doing the single point of concentration technique is so good because it's attempting to focus the mind and not just caught up in every single thought. That's what you're trying to do in that meditation. And the immediate benefit's marvelous. One is you're steadying it for a moment, even though it's a great effort. But two, you're also beginning to notice the thoughts, which is really important. And then we have to learn to distinguish between them, the neuroses, the virtues, and then grow the virtues, grow the wisdom, grow the clarity. In other words, if you were learning... to what expertise do you have? What's your job?
Researcher.
Oh, okay. Well, do something more technical. Let's say more technical, like learn the piano. You really know, don't you? If you're trying to learn the piano, it's like asking, well, what if I just daydream and play any note I feel like? You're saying like that, aren't you? Now, if that's cool, if that's what you want. But if you're trying to learn Bach, it won't get you far. You've got to have precision, discipline, precision. Absolutely, you've got to know exactly, you've got a half a note wrong, you've got to fix it. That kind of clarity, like we have with numbers, that's the kind of clarity that Buddha would say we need to develop, and what we're talking about is virtuous thoughts, wise thoughts, clear thoughts. The other just kind of yucky, wool, strange, wishy-washy, and indeed it can be really miserable and psychotic when you look at some unhappy people. Do you see? So it demands enormous rigor. I mean, it seems exhausting in the beginning. But eventually what comes from this is a happy mind. And a happy mind can also be a busy mind. But it's a mind that's clear, that's optimistic, that's kind, generous, good at what it's doing, wants to help others, develop yourself, rejoice in good qualities, have fun, enjoy the cake. Do you understand? You don't need to daydream. You're busy doing positive things, like playing the piano. I'm using the analogy. You see my point? It's 8:33 and it says I'm supposed to finish at 8:30. So are there urgent questions before we finish? Were there more questions? Any more questions? Go, Deanne. Yes, please, sweetheart. Ask.
They're not so involved.
It's okay, Deanne. It's okay, darling. Go.
Okay, these are technical. The first two technical questions.
Yes, Deanne.
I'm trying to get the lineages straight.
Yes, good.
Okay, so from the Buddha to Manjushri... to Nagarjuna.
This is for the wisdom teaching.
Yes, the wisdom.
Right.
To Nagarjuna, to Shantideva. Who is the one that made it not secret? Start with a C.
Okay, it went from Shantideva in India, the 8th century, and then in about the 10th century, Atisha was an Indian. Atisha was an Indian master and scholar in the 10th century. Uh-huh. And he was invited to Tibet.
Right.
And he got his teachings from he went to Indonesia for his teacher, Tsalingpa. He was from the Shantideva tradition, from the big Nalanda monastery, this great yogi, meditator, the Bodhisattva mm-hmm. teachings. Mm-hmm. Shantideva was a student of all this. And then he went to Tsalingpa in Indonesia. It took about a year to get there. And then he got all these teachings on exchanging self for others from him. Then he took them to Tibet, where he taught them and kept them secret. And then his disciples, Drumtompa, Langri Tangpa, and eventually they made them more open.
Who was the one that made it open first?
The Drumtompa and his disciples. These guys, Langri Tangpa. These guys, in whatever century it was. I'm a bit confused about the history. came from Salingpa. It came from Atisha to Tibet, and that came directly from the Shantideva lineage via his own guru called Salingpa, who gave him all the secret, the teachings on exchanging self for others, which he then brought to Tibet, and then he taught them to his disciples, and then his disciples brought them to his disciples, and then they made them more open.
Okay, the next one is, now, there seems to be a subtle difference between equalization and equanimity.
There's a completely different thing.
Yeah.
It's quite different.
The first one, equanimity.
Uh-huh.
Take that one first.
Equanimity is you looking at a friend, an enemy, and a stranger.
And have the same feeling.
And realize, no, precisely realizing they're equal to each other in their wish to be happy and not suffer. That's the exact meaning of equanimity. When you genuinely know that creepy enemy, but they're a human being, they want to be happy, just like my beloved. There's no more than that. Already that's pretty profound.
Okay.
That's equanimity. The meaning here of equanimity is that equalizing self for others is four steps on, where you now, the groups you're comparing are you and everyone else. You're seeing that everyone else in the world is equal to you, is the same as you in wanting to be happy and wanting not to suffer. And then the next step from there is gradually to do the exchanging.
Right. So what's the difference? I'm not seeing the difference.
Okay, equanimity.
And
from your perspective, you, Diane, doing the practice, she thinks of an enemy, a friend, and a stranger. Mm-hmm. And Diane's observation of these three is that they are the same as each other from the point of view of wanting to be happy and wanting not to suffer. So the conclusion from this is you want them, eventually you'll want them all three to be happy and all not to suffer, because you are seeing them all as equal to each other. Nothing to do with you. You're the observer. You're the observer here. Five steps on, you get to equalizing self with others, and you are now the one who's comparing with everybody else in relation to you.
There we go.
They're the same as me. Oh, my God. They want to be happy just like I do.
Excellent. I got it now.
Got it. Okay,
you can go home now.
That's the one. Okay. Time goes so fast, I can't help it. If I could slow it down, I would. But I can't. And so we think, here we've been, hour and a half. As much as made sense, maybe none of it's made sense. I'm sorry if it didn't. Some of it did. If there's a few tools from this, a few thoughts to take, a few things we'd like to continue, that's marvelous. All these, and the Buddha would say, of course, as we know from the Buddha's understanding of the mind, every thought we've had has gone in. We've programmed our mind with it. How marvelous. So we take from this wish to use whatever tools we can to continue to develop our amazing potential so we can eventually, you know, accomplish these outrageous levels of realization where we can really exchange self for others, become an amazing being, wanting only to help others. One step at a time. Chang chob sem chogrin po che ma ke pa nam ke gyo chig ke pa nyam pa me pa yang gong ne gong du pa ba shok ge wa ji nyu du dag Lama Sange Drup Gyurne Drowa Chikyang Malupa Deyi Sala Kupashu. Okay. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, thank you, thank you. See you next time. I'm off to Kentucky tomorrow to see my friend Mitch on death row in Eddyville. He's got a death date coming soon, I'd say, in a year or so. So I'll give him love from all of you guys, okay? Eddie, and I'll maybe see a few others in Eddyville. Mitch and a few others. Okay, I'll be back. Hopefully, weather being all right, I'll be back on Wednesday. Maybe the snow will be impossible. I don't know, but I'll be stuck in it. I hope not to be stuck in Eddyville anyway. I'll see you Wednesday night. Thanks, everybody.